Support for Word of Mouth comes from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. You can discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers. I met this guy, Justin. He works at a drug rehab center.
I'm a case manager. Well, I was born in Keene, but I grew up in Stoddard.
Basically, his job is to help people figure out how to treat their addiction. It's something he's wanted to do for a long time. He also runs a sober living house in Manchester. His job there is to make it the most supportive environment possible. A decade ago, Justin's life, the way it is right now, would have been unimaginable to him. He was 17 years old. He was homeless. His uncle had just given him his first hit of heroin. He started buying it whenever he could. He wound up in the county jail for a few months, and after that, he went to the state prison up in Berlin. I asked him, when he got incarcerated, did that put a pause on his opioid addiction?
No, I got high the whole time. I was in Berlin. That was really easy. Yeah, I left prison with a worse habit than I went in with.
At that point in his life, Justin felt hopeless.
I had already chalked up my fate, you know. I didn't think that it was ever going to happen any other way than it had been happening. I mean, I was just misinformed by the misinformed, right? And I mean, I knew it was a problem, but I didn't realistically see a solution to the problem.
Part of why opioid addiction is so complicated, so difficult to treat, is that it's not just a physical dependence. It's also a mental health disorder. Stuff like anxiety and depression frequently go hand in hand with substance use. And prison just is not a great environment for working out your issues.
New Hampshire's got this thing where they, you know, we can either rehabilitate or we can incarcerate, and we've picked the incarceration route.
I will say Justin eventually found treatment that worked for him. He got into a very unusual residential treatment facility in upstate New York, sort of a work-for-your-keep situation. This place happened to be an actual castle, apparently built by a real estate tycoon who was an accountant for the Ringling Brothers. It's a whole thing. The point is, when he got away from the New Hampshire prison system into a better environment, everything changed.
You know, I learned that there was a totally different way to live, a better way to live, and I didn't have to be like that little, you know, misinformed bubble that I was in for so long, and that like anything was possible.
Hello and welcome to Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Ben Henry. This is the second episode in our four-part series answering the questions that listeners sent us about incarceration in New Hampshire. A listener, Jeannie, wrote to us and asked, how do prisons in New Hampshire deal with the opioid crisis? Everyone's journey through treating the disease of addiction is different. For Justin, and his was an exceptional case, it took a castle. Few of the people who I've met said their time in prison helped them recover from addiction. More often, they say the opposite. Incarceration made their addiction worse, made it harder to get treatment, financially, socially, psychologically harder. And so Jeannie's question is basically, do the people who run prisons and jails know this, and what are they doing about it? Jeannie, if you're listening, hi. The answer is complicated. But let me start by introducing you to a very cool person who researches criminal justice.
I'm Nazgul Gandnoush. I'm a senior researcher at the Sentencing Project.
And you wrote a report back in, was it 2017?
I'm failing the first question.
It was 2017-ish. And it was December of 2017. Gandnoush wrote about what was causing the opioid epidemic.
Health insurance providers have made it really quite easy for people to access opioids. But they haven't made it as easy for people to access treatment when they then develop substance use disorder. So that's, I think, the first step is to make sure to improve healthcare provision in communities so that people do not end up having to be behind bars. And so we know also that overall, people in prisons and jails have a really high level of substance use disorder. So it's over 60% of people that are imprisoned or in jails and county jails around the country reported having a problem with drugs in the year prior to their admission. And so that's a level that's 10 times as high as the general population when you adjust.
This means the majority of people who are in the average jail or prison around the country also have a substance use disorder. That's a really high proportion. There are a couple of reasons for it. For one thing, of course, just possessing something like heroin is a crime. But also,
people that are incarcerated are disproportionately low-income people. Low-income people are especially likely to face barriers in accessing health care. And so that's definitely a part of it. So we know from surveys that if you ask people who have a drug use disorder why they did not get treatment, for people who did want treatment, their main reasons that they state are because they didn't have health insurance and they couldn't afford the cost of treatment.
It's hard to know specifically how many people who are incarcerated here in New Hampshire have a history of drug or alcohol misuse. The state hasn't compiled that information. It's probably more than half, and in some county jails, it could be as high as 60-70%.
Especially in rural communities where people have a harder time accessing treatment. Sometimes sheriffs, police leaders, they support the idea of just trying to lock people up because there's nothing else that they can do for them.
Like in a lot of states, we don't have enough mental health providers in New Hampshire to meet the demand here. And that's true for addiction services. Whether you want to get counseling or get into an intense residential treatment program, you may end up on a waiting list. Or worse, if you get arrested, you may end up detoxing in jail. I won't get into the details of opioid withdrawal, but it's 2 weeks of hell. And there's a dangerous consequence down the road.
When they're released, they have a much lower level of tolerance to the drugs than when they went in. Many people are not aware of how much their bodies have changed during their period of incarceration.
With heroin, like with most drugs, coffee for that matter, you build up a tolerance. When you get out of jail, your tolerance is gone. And it's really, really easy to accidentally take too much.
And if they resume drug use at anywhere close to the levels that they've been previously using drugs, they're very likely to die from an overdose.
In one study of people who died within 6 weeks of release from a jail in New York City, almost half of those deaths were overdoses. Again, nobody knows exactly how big this problem is in New Hampshire. The chief medical examiner here and the Department of Corrections are planning to compile that information, but they don't have it yet. And before now, they didn't study this mortality rate. So put the numbers aside for a second. The one thing that gets many, many people through their struggle with opioids is their family, their community, their support network. In prison, you don't have any of that, or if you do, it's limited. What you do have is a stressful, sometimes hostile environment. The psychological effect of going to prison is real.
It's almost like a disconnect.
This is Sam Hayes. He's a therapist at a rehab clinic in Nashua.
You have this mentality, it's angry, fearful, like, I don't know how to go get a job kind of thing. And it's survival mode. And they come out in the survival mode and they take it out in groups and they don't know how to communicate with people the right way. Or there's just an extreme adjustment period.
Incarceration can be isolating.
And that's one of the biggest things I've seen that people in jail have a hard time overcoming. It's that whole, like, don't ask, don't tell. I'm going to hold my emotions in. So a huge part of my job is forcing them to find something, or find a way to get them to talk about their emotions, because that's a huge part of recovery.
As of right now, if you're incarcerated in New Hampshire, you are probably not receiving proper treatment for addiction. This is because, according to medical experts, the best way to treat opioid addiction is with medications. There are meds that can root out the disease by changing your brain chemistry. That's what doctors agree is most effective for most people when you combine it with more traditional methods like therapy and group counseling. For the moment, you can't get a prescription for any of the medications for treating opioid addiction while you're incarcerated in New Hampshire. There are some exceptions, like for pregnant women. And in a state prison, you can get one shot of one medication right when you leave. And it's all beginning to change, especially in the state prisons. But for years now, the medical community has known that medications are a crucial component of treatment, and incarcerated people have, by and large, not had access to them. One doctor who feels this way is Margaret Botter. She's a psychiatrist in Belmont. She specializes in addiction, and she was one of the first people in New Hampshire to start using medications to treat addiction.
When I started in 2006, I had a lot of people who were addicted to pain medication, OxyContin especially back then. Well, throughout the years, everything changed. I think fentanyl especially changed totally the game on the street. And it's so addictive. Not that OxyContin wasn't, because it was. Opioid is opioid. It will affect brain the same way. But with the fentanyl and carfentanil now on streets, it's, I mean, we all know it's killing people. And it's killing them in a sense that they don't even realize how addicted they are and how difficult it is for them to stop. And without medication, I don't think it's possible. Honestly, I think, you know, there's a lot of people who still believe that somehow counseling and group intensive programs without medication will be with the same effect. And I disagree with that. I don't think not providing medication on top of counseling and group sessions, I don't see how anybody can think that we can beat that opioid epidemic without using medication.
I want to be really clear. The point Dr. Botter is making is that medication is only one component of addiction treatments, but it's the component that's currently lacking the most, especially inside of prisons. What you can't do is use medication to replace all of the other parts of treatment, like going to therapy or group counseling, or all the social services that help people recover, like housing and health insurance. The broader medical community backs up what Dr. Botter is saying. The branch of the federal government that deals with this kind of thing is SAMHSA. That's short for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They've said that medication-assisted treatment is the standard of care for addiction to opioids. Medication just is not a silver bullet. Take Justin, for example, that case manager you heard from earlier. Medication was not part of his recovery. Some people give Suboxone a try and it doesn't work out. Or they just don't like taking anything that can potentially be misused, not even cold medicine. And that is a really common and valid feeling.
There is no miracle treatments, but it's really nice to see people when they take first dose of Suboxone. And most often what they would say is, I couldn't believe that I can feel so normal.
There is a legal question here, which is, if you get incarcerated, do you actually have a right to receive this kind of medication? I asked a lawyer who thinks about this kind of question. His name is Henry Clementowitz. He works for the New Hampshire branch of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union.
Right now, it sort of depends on where you are. The ACLU of Massachusetts brought a lawsuit against the jail in Massachusetts in federal court, where that jail did not provide methadone to a person whose doctor had prescribed him on methadone and who came before the court and said, you know, this is a life-saving treatment that I need, or there's a real risk of relapse and death. And they raised a constitutional challenge under the Eighth Amendment with cruel and unusual punishment. They raised a challenge under the Americans with Disability Act, and a federal judge in Massachusetts agreed and ordered that the person had to be provided methadone in jail.
In the past, the Supreme Court has said the prisons have to provide medical care to prisoners under the Eighth Amendment. That case for Massachusetts was a pretty narrow situation in which a person already had a prescription when they were incarcerated. There is still a question as to whether everyone has a right to medication for addiction. Some medical professionals who work inside of prisons and jails here in New Hampshire want to provide medication for addiction, regardless of the legal situation. They have a problem, though. One of the most common and effective medications is itself a type of opioid. It's called buprenorphine, but you might know it as Suboxone. The way it works, it blocks some of the receptors that respond to heroin, but it activates a few of them, just enough to keep a person from going into withdrawal. So if you take more than you're supposed to, or if you just don't have a tolerance to opioids, that little bit of activation will get you high. People buy this stuff outside of jails and inside of them. The people who run jails and who write laws about jails usually try to keep Suboxone out of the facility. If they're going to deliberately bring it in, they have to be convinced it's not going to get misused. Here's Dr. Botter again.
You know, a lot of people who I, for example, see, they on Suboxone, they're going to court, they have to go to a jail or prison for a certain period of time, and they know that they're not going to be able to continue Suboxone. Well, what happens is they go through withdrawals, they leave the jail, and most likely what happens, if they cannot get to the program right away, they relapse and the cycle happens again, right?
I am not the first person to make this observation, but it's still worth saying. Being incarcerated makes you invisible to the outside world. Same goes for opioid addiction. The fact that the opioid crisis is happening in prisons and jails casts the whole thing in the shadows. But at the same time, if we're going to change policy to address the crisis, correctional policy is the place to start, right? In some states, in the last few years, the world of corrections has gradually started to say yes. Here in New Hampshire, we're about to try something kind of bold, providing that medication, Suboxone, along with another medication, Vivitrol, within the state prison system. This idea is more complicated than it sounds, and we're not the first state to do it. That distinction goes to Rhode Island. Cool. So, I'll just ask you to introduce yourself, if you don't mind.
I'm Jennifer Clark. I'm the medical program director for the Rhode Island Department of Corrections. I've been here about 20 years. I've been mostly as a primary care physician. Having worked here for so many years, I've known so many people who have died. You know, people who I've, you know, helped them with their pneumonia, helped them with their diabetes. But my hands have been tied as far as helping them with their opiate use disorders. They'll tell me that they know they're going to use. They know, you know, the disease is so strong for certain individuals. They're afraid of dying. They beg me to start them on methadone. I can't do it. I can get them an appointment. But those take time, and they get out and they die of an overdose. And that feels terrible. It feels terrible knowing there's something I could do to help, but because of a policy, I'm not allowed to do it.
3 years ago, Clark was promoted to a position where she could affect policy.
I have for years been thinking about what would the best treatment be? What would I want to see? So it happened when I got this job, I had already been thinking about it for years, what I wanted.
The governor put together an opioid task force in 2016. Clark went to them and made her case.
We have to remember that forced abstinence is not treatment. So just because somebody's not using drugs while they're incarcerated does not mean that they have been cured of addiction.
The plan was to evaluate everyone who came into the prison system, and if they wanted to receive medication like Suboxone, and the nurses thought that that was the right treatment, they would get that medication for as long as they stayed with the Department of Corrections. And this is important, the department would refer them to a provider outside of the prison when they left so that they could continue the medication if they had the insurance and the money to do so. Rhode Island has this unified prison system, so no county jails, and everyone is in the same facility. That made it a lot easier to implement all these new policies. What difference did that make that you guys were able to document? Like, what was the effect?
We were able to demonstrate a 60% decrease in mortality post-release. I wasn't expecting such a large decrease, but it was very exciting. I think that really energized our whole group to sort of kick up the pace at which we provide services.
That number, that 60% drop in mortality, other people took notice. Rhode Island became a role model for other states. Their system was a sort of proof of concept. And now states like Massachusetts have tried to scale that system up to larger states with more complicated prison systems. Jennifer Clark has a talk that she gives to corrections professionals about how to do what Rhode Island is doing. One of the people who has heard that talk is the director of the Medical Services Division at the New Hampshire Department of Corrections, Paula Mattis. The department got a federal grant to the tune of a couple $1 million they'll be using in 2019 to make Suboxone available in the state prisons, along with that other medication, Vivitrol, which works differently and can't be misused. That's only for the 3 state prisons, the 10 county jails in New Hampshire, where people go for any sentence that's less than a year and which handle a higher volume of people, will not receive that federal money. Some of them do have plans to start using medication for addiction treatment, but they'll have to scrape together their own funding. While medication is becoming more available, other types of programs that focus on therapy and giving people resources when they're released from incarceration, those are popping up in jails around the state too. They're small, like the 24-person treatment program in the Hillsborough County Jail, but they're promising. When you look outside of jails and prisons, there is still an enormous shortage of mental health providers in New Hampshire. The waiting list to get on Suboxone can take months. And hundreds of people still die every year from opioids, mostly fentanyl and heroin, though the numbers are declining. Even if they keep going down, this isn't just about, you know, Suboxone specifically, or even opioids. It's about making sure we can systematically see a drug crisis coming and provide the right healthcare to stop it. Otherwise, it'll just keep happening. That case manager you heard from earlier, Justin, he actually wasn't supposed to be getting treatment for his addiction at that castle in upstate New York. Leaving New Hampshire violated his parole. After a year and a half there, he came back because he wanted to straighten out that parole issue. He says he was a totally different person. That place he went to gave him way more resources than the kind of four-week program that most people get into, if they get into any rehab program at all. Justin found this new ambition to guide other people through the fog of opioids that he had just cut through. His parole officer told him, you know, a violation is a violation. You're going back to jail for 6 months. So he did. He got out last September. He was in Manchester when he got out. He doesn't know anybody who lives in Manchester. He went to a homeless shelter over on Lowell Street, helping hands. He decided to go to an AA meeting, figured that was the place to find resources to get him back on his feet.
So I was walking, and I ended up going to the wrong place. And the place I ended up showing up for was New Hampshire Hope for Recovery, and it was locked. I didn't even know what it was. It was like just like an old factory building. And I couldn't get in. Some guy pulled in the parking lot. You know, we started talking. He's like, yeah, he's like, you're just a little early. Like, it doesn't open for another like hour or two. He worked there. So I asked him if I could volunteer. So he had me fill in these balloons. And they were like these purple balloons. Well, it was 189 balloons. I filled them up. He gave me like a Sharpie and like a list of names. He's like, now I need you to write these names on the balloons. These were all the people who have overdosed this year in the state of New Hampshire. This entire ceiling of this place is just full of these purple balloons. So like I wrote all these names on them and I went out and I tied them on the fence over on Valley Street, that whole fence there. All these guys come in, and as the case manager, like, I'm with them their entire way. And we got so many guys who come in and they're just hopeless. There's no other options, you know, and it's hard trying to get somebody to believe that, like, I was hopeless too, you know.
Those plans that the state has to improve access to medication for addiction treatment in prisons, those will likely be rolled out this year. And the state may soon compile some new data about opioids in prisons. All this to say, we're going to keep checking in. And when there are new parts of this story to tell, we'll tell you. In the meantime, I just want to point out that this whole story came from one person emailing us a question. I had no idea it would take so long to answer, but I'm glad we did. If there is something you think we should look into, send it our way. It doesn't have to be about prisons. It can be weird or small or personal. It doesn't matter. It just has to be in New Hampshire. Our email is wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Wordofmouth@nhpr.org. For example, what are the big questions on your mind about education in New Hampshire? Or race? Or your own mysterious past? We'll look into it if you want us to. This episode was produced by me, Ben Henry. Our staff includes Jimmy Gutierrez, Justine Paradise, and Daniela Ali. Our executive producer is Erica Janik. And as always, we're coming to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio.